Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Any policy that says you can't serve, even though you want to be an American, you are an American, is wrong, bad for our military service, and bad for the country.
Senator Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor on Saturday. Tomorrow, by the way, we'll take a closer look at how they will now move to implement the open integration of gays and lesbians into the armed forces and where that is expected to be easy, where that is expected to be difficult, some of the unanswered questions as to how they actually do it. We'll do that on tomorrow's show. Also on tomorrow's program, by the way, we have Steve Martin to talk about his new novel about the New York City art scene and why his recent appearance at the 92nd Street Y was apparently too artsy for the audience. That's Steve Martin and how to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell tomorrow morning here on The Brian Lehrer Show. With us now, someone who was there when the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was first enacted in the Clinton administration, Jamie Floyd, who sometimes fills in for me on this program, as you may know, who blogs for a politics website, itsafreecountry.org, and who worked for the Clinton administration at the time Don't Ask, Don't Tell was enacted, and even tried to talk General Colin Powell out of it at the time when Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Hi, Jamie. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. I don't want to make too much out of it. Yes, I was in the room, and yes, I expressed my legal misgivings as an advisor to Vice President Gore. And yes, I certainly did directly make analogies to the desegregation of the armed forces in the 1940s, 1948. President Truman, of course, signed that executive order. I thought that would be very persuasive. And I wasn't the only one in the room who made those analogies. But I was just one of many voices at the time that expressed concern. This was a compromise, as you'll remember, Brian, after President Clinton had made that campaign promise that gays would be permitted to serve in the military. And so I was just one of many. And the military, the Joint Chiefs, and Colin Powell won out at the time with the report of with the support of Republicans in Congress.
It was a compromised position from the outright ban that had come before. And by the way, I don't know if you heard Commander Coy, who was on just a moment ago, who referred to George Washington being the first president to expel a troop being gay. Well, we looked that up, and according to the website, the Bilaric Project, the discharge was of one Lieutenant Frederick Gotthold Enslin, who in 1778 was ejected from the Continental Army for allegedly trying to, quote, sodomize a fellow soldier. So it wasn't, if that's true, it wasn't just for being gay. It was for inappropriate behavior, which, of course, would still be banned. General George Washington demanded that Enslin be dismissed from the service with infamy, as he put it at the time. He was, quote, to be drummed out of camp tomorrow morning by all the drummers and fifers in the army, never to return. So get the flute players out on that sodomizer.
That's right. And I remember that because we cited that case in our memo, arguing that a long time had passed since 1778 by the time Don't Ask, Don't Tell was proposed. But before Don't Ask, Don't Tell, as you point out, Brian, it was inappropriate in the eyes of the armed forces to be gay and in the military. It was, from their point of view, incompatible with military service. And you would either be dishonorably discharged if you were gay and acted upon it, or unfavorably discharged if you were gay and and did not act upon it. It was called an undesirable discharge. Either way, unacceptable in my view. And even though, Brian, you talked earlier about all of the passion involved with this issue, I was a lawyer. I was dispassionate about it as much as I could be, but trained as a lawyer, I just thought it was unconstitutional. And I put that out there, and I'm glad that Congress acted on this because I think it would have gone to the courts and would have ultimately been found so. And now we've avoided all of that. I think the political solution, as I wrote on It's a Free Country, was the right solution because this was a political decision in the first place.
And they get to roll it out more gradually, as they hope to do, going through the political process this way, rather than having it repealed all at once by the courts, which may well have happened. Also joining us now, two other It's a Free Country contributors, Solomon Kleinsmith, author of the politically centrist blog called Rise of the Center. You may remember he was here last week as a participant in the No Labels Conference for Political Independents and Moderates, and conservative blogger Carol Markowitz, who you can also read at alarmingnews.com, along with Jamie Floyd, who is still here. We will call them the It's a Free Country All-Stars. All three have been blogging on our politics website, It's a Free Country. Hi, Solomon. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Solomon, was this the Rise of the Center moment in American politics, or a Rise of the Center moment? The sponsors of the repeal were Joe Lieberman, independent Democrat, and Susan Collins, moderate Republican.
I don't know if it's that. It's the center agrees with the left on this issue, and there are other issues that the center agrees with the right on. This is just one of those things where finally the people on the right who have been trying to stonewall it for a long time have been overpowered by the center and the left.
Carol, for the record, you're a conservative, but I gather you support this repeal, correct?
I do, and I mean, it's an 80-20 issue. There was no bravery here. Nobody took a bold stand, really. Most Americans supported repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the Senate just reflected that public opinion.
But what do you make of the list of eight Republicans who voted for repeal? In addition to Susan Collins, it was Scott Brown of Massachusetts, Richard Burr of North Carolina, John Anson of Nevada, Mark Kirk of Illinois, George Voinovich of Ohio, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. In other ways, that's a very diverse group, Carol, isn't it?
It is. Most of them are in blue states, not North Carolina or Alaska. But I think Murkowski felt she had some leeway with the moderates in her state. And again, there was no boldness here. It wasn't like they legislated gay marriage. You know, if you want to see real boldness, make the Senate vote on that. But Don't Ask, Don't Tell is such a popular position to take. Nobody took a really, you know, outlandish stand here.
Mm-hmm. So,
well, that depends on how you look at it, though, because it is bold in the sense of there are going to be a lot of people that are Republican primary voters that are going to have a problem with this.
So,
I doubt that. I really think that the numbers, the poll numbers, really reflect Republicans and Democrats, and it's just 80-20 issues are not what people vote on. And I doubt that it's going to be a primary issue. I mean, where? North Carolina? Just unlikely.
Do you feel differently, Carol, about the DREAM Act? Because that was also going to be something to sort of legitimize the status of people who were serving in the armed forces, as well as if they had gone to 2 years of college, if they came here as illegal immigrants as children.
Right. Well, DREAM Act had a much different poll number skew. Many less Americans supported that, and again, their leadership just reflected that. And you know, if the Senate had moved for the DREAM Act, that might have been a bold stand. But you know, but taking a position on an 80-20 issue where you side with the 80% is.
I think fewer Americans understand and understood the DREAM Act. I think 17 years of education on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and Americans fully appreciate what the issue was, whether and what it meant to them. And I think, maybe I'm just an idealist, but I think when Congress voted on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they really, each individual legislator voted their heart on that issue. I think with the DREAM Act, it was much more of a cynical vote, and they voted politically, voted their constituency on that issue.
I think a lot of voters
have been much more manipulated, I think, on that issue.
I mean, on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I've heard people on both sides say, well, now gay people will be able to serve in the military. Well, they've been serving all along. It's just now they'll be able to serve openly. So I'm not really sure that people knew exactly what Don't Ask, Don't Tell meant. They just knew intrinsically that gay people should be allowed to be themselves in the military.
Although a lot of young
people didn't know that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was actually a pro-gay policy when it was enacted. It was a compromise. It wasn't a way to exclude gay people. It was a way to include them.
Although 14,000 service members have been discharged under that policy, pro-gay though you may call it.
Right. How many were discharged before that policy?
Well, we'd have to go back and count. I would agree with you that many must have been because it was more discriminatory than Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But I would guess that many gay Americans who are listening would not feel that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a pro-gay policy.
So, Solomon, as the centrist in the room, where are you on the DREAM Act?
That's a tough one because, I mean, there are some confusing aspects of it that I'm not exactly sure how they would have played out. But the core of it, that if somebody serves in the military that comes from another country, that they should be, you know, allowed to be a citizen, I mean, that's a simple one. They should obviously be able to do that. And if somebody comes into the country that has a valuable skill that our economy needs and comes in and, you know, gets educated and whatnot, then getting rid of them is absurd. You know, we need people that can bring money into our economy. And I know they have rules that if somebody brings a certain amount of money and starts a business in the country, that they get to stay. Those are common sense things that can help our economy. And, it, you know, if you're against those, I really don't understand why.
Carol, are you?
Yes.
Against it?
I think that anything that legitimizes illegal entry into our country, I'm not for it. I know that there's a lot of heartstring pulling, and I'm an immigrant, a legal immigrant to this country, and I just don't think that anything that, and any act that legitimizes breaking the law to be here should be applauded.
Jamie, do you happen to know they don't check your, as a lawyer, they don't check your immigration status when you try to sign up for the armed forces?
Yes, it's quite fascinating. and you know, as Solomon points out, the DREAM Act is very, very complicated because with some of the people who would qualify, they would qualify through services where they would not have had their immigration status checked and then become legitimized through, say, service in the armed forces. Other people would have served in other ways our country. And you saw all of this, I thought somewhat, and I say this as, I guess, our representative of the left, I did think it was somewhat jingoism about pledging allegiance to the flag, and though certainly I am one to pledge allegiance to the flag, but it was heartstring pulling. I mean, I agree with Carol on that. At the same time, I think there is a point, I'm just going to come right out and say it, I think there was a point to be made about some degree of racism attached to our resistance to this legislation. I think this was a much tougher issue in some ways, and I have to say I agree with Carol, a much tougher issue than Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which seemed like a cleaner, easier case. But I think a lot of it, again, Brian, has to do with the amount of time that's passed. We've been arguing about Don't Ask, Don't Tell for 17 years. The DREAM Act kind of came out of nowhere. We had to get our minds around a very big, complicated, I think not very well crafted piece of legislation, and I think a lot of it had to do with our inability and of the legislators themselves to understand it and explain it well to the American people.
We're talking with our It's a Free Country all-stars, Solomon Kleinsmith, author of the politically centrist blog called Rise of the Center, conservative blogger Carol Markowitz, and Jamie Floyd, who blogs at It's a Free Country and sometimes sits in for me on this radio show. Carol, how are you feeling about the tax compromise? Some Tea Party conservatives, I don't know if you consider yourself in that camp or not, are not happy with this as it went against the prime directive not to increase the deficit, and this has $800 billion of new borrowing. Where are you on this whole compromise?
I have never seen a tax cut I didn't like, but the compromise is it will just increase our deficit. It really did go away against this last election's result. I don't know if I consider myself a Tea Partier, but I'm a conservative. I don't like spending. I don't like 99 weeks of unemployment insurance with very little oversight on it. Yeah, I don't think it was the greatest compromise, but, you know, the fact is, in 2008, we elected Barack Obama. He's a Democrat, he's a liberal, and this is the kind of thing we're going to get as Americans until we elect conservatives, and just one midterm election, it wasn't going to change that.
So that was the best they could do from your perspective,
exactly.
So you would go for it. Solomon, how about you on that tax compromise?
Well, we talked about this last time I was on here, and I really don't see it as a compromise. It was more of a trade where the right got what they wanted in the continuing the tax cuts for everybody, mm-hmm. and the left got what they wanted in continuing the unemployment benefits without having to pay for it. I think, you know, the unemployment benefits could have been paid for somehow, at least part of it, and that would have been a compromise for them, and a compromise on the right would have really been them not continuing the tax cuts for everybody and bringing it down to maybe $750 or a million or, you know, something that's not for everybody. But, you know, she's right in that this is $800 billion. We just can't keep doing that anymore. We just can't.
How about this next spending debate now taking place on something very few Americans understand, Jamie, the omnibus spending bill that keeps the government running? This seems to be where many Republicans are drawing their lines in the sand. Do you understand the issue here?
Well, we have a 2,000-page bill, and that's not an exaggeration. I'm not just making that number up. It's 1,900 pages. It's a foot tall. And it's what they're about to give us is basically just a stopgap measure till March. They couldn't even come to an agreement. You know, Congress, something like 13% on Friday, there was a poll, 13% of Americans approve of the job that Congress is doing. Well, it's no wonder why. Their basic job there is to pass a spending bill, and they can't even do that. And I have to put it on my party. The Democrats really have only themselves to blame. They managed to go a whole year without passing a single spending bill, a federal budget bill, and the primary purpose of Congress is to pass a spending bill, and they were dominant in both houses, and they failed to pass the bill. And now we have Republicans coming in. We have no idea what's going to happen when they take over the House next year. That's anyone's guess. And what happened, Brian, is the Republicans, they had a compromise going between Harry Reid, the leader in the House, and McConnell. And then the Republicans were embarrassed by how much pork was in the bill after they'd been railing against pork. And the Tea Partiers essentially put them up against the wall and said, wait a minute, what's all this pork you put in there? We're not supposed to be the party of pork. Mm. They had $1 million in peanut research in Georgia and 3.7 for water and sewage systems in Pennsylvania and $12 million for replacing some lock that had drained out between two big lakes in Michigan so that the ships could go back and forth. And they basically pulled out in embarrassment and the whole thing collapsed. So now there's no spending bill. And this is for the 2011 budget. So we're talking about next year going forward, we've got no bill.
We're talking about the current fiscal year, 2011.
The current, what is essentially the current fiscal year. We're already in it.
Carol, right? Is this a place for Republicans and conservatives to draw a line in the sand? Can the public come to understand this?
Nobody likes blaming the Democrats more than I do, so I will join Jamie in saying that Democrats have been just completely absent on this. They had control of both houses. They had the presidency. If you can't pass a spending bill then, when can you? And, yeah, I do hope that the new Republicans rein in the spending. That's what they ran on. That's how they should govern. That's what the American people are waiting for. There's a reason that Chris Christie is, you know, quote-unquote, this rock star, because he's saying the truth. Like, we don't have the money. We don't have it. That doesn't exist. So we can't just keep spending like this. We can't just keep pretending that everything is going to be okay, because everything is not going to be okay. And this recession really highlighted that.
It is easier, Carol, I'm sure you will agree, to be the party in opposition than it is to be the party that has to lead.
Absolutely. Definitely. So if the Democrats want to take that easier position and be the party of opposition, well, we're happy to take over both houses and lead the way.
But after the Republicans took control of Congress during the Clinton era in 94, something like this happened. And Newt Gingrich, as Speaker of the House, led an actual government shutdown over it. Jamie, were you around for that?
Oh, yeah. That's all I have to say.
So, Carol, yeah, do we want to go?
That's a really good example.
Solomon, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a really good example, because in the beginning it seemed like they actually practiced what they preached, and I was a teenager when that happened. That was when I first was starting to pay attention to politics. And, you know, if they take over, well, they're taking over now, sort of. They're taking over part of it. If they practice what they preach, there's a pretty good chance that they're going to continue getting gains for the next couple cycles. But if they do what they did the few years after the Gingrich Revolution and all that, then, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, because as a lot of Republicans now have been pointing out back then, they took power and then they squandered it.
Squandered it how, in your opinion, Solomon, looking back on it?
Well, and Joe Scarborough talks about this a lot. They took over both houses, and then they worked with Bill Clinton, but they didn't follow up in saying that they were going to shrink government, and they took power, and they, they didn't cut government. They didn't cut taxes very much. You know, they just didn't follow through. And with the Tea Party pushing them even farther to the right, they've been making a lot of promises that I doubt they'll deliver on. But if they do, then, you know, they'll probably continue gaining. But it's unlikely that the Republican Party, they like talking about making tax cuts, which is pretty easy to pass because tax cuts are popular. You know, who isn't for tax cuts if you can afford them? But they're not willing to go then and cut spending. And so if you do one, not the other, you're really raising taxes for our kids. And that's not fair.
That's right.
But it's easy politically to do.
Solomon liked to rub in the fact that he was just a teenager back when I was already working as an adult. I will point out, though, that there are advantages to getting older, and that is that you remember some of the lessons you learned. And we know that President Obama had President Clinton to the White House, I think it was just last week, and perhaps some of what they were talking about was the strategy back from 94-95. And I think some very important lessons were learned. I think Solomon is right that Republicans squandered that opportunity. But some of it was also the bridge. But, you know, we know that President Clinton is a brilliant political strategist, and maybe President Obama can learn from some of that.
Carol, you can get the last word here.
Clinton is a brilliant political strategist. I don't think Obama is. I think that his compromises here show that. I actually agree with Solomon that Republicans can squander with the best of them all opportunities. So everybody has their pet projects. Republicans are no different. Again, I hope that the conservatives do hold them to the promises they made in this election and cut the budget.
The It's a Free Country All-Stars, blogging on politics from left, right, and center, roughly speaking. Jamie Floyd, Solomon Kleinsmith, Carol Markowitz. Okay, before you all go, quickly, are you each taking a stand on whether the health insurance mandate is unconstitutional? Carol, are you taking a position on that?
Absolutely, unconstitutional.
Solomon, can there be a centrist position on this, or is it just yes or no?
I'm not a scholar in constitutional law, but I disagree with it. I don't know if it, you know, the Supreme Court can decide on that, but I think it's wrong.
To have a mandate.
Yeah, the individual mandate, I think it's wrong.
And, Jamie, you're a ringer. You're an actual lawyer.
It goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, and Kennedy decides that it's constitutional.
Thank you. Kennedy decides it. A 5-4 vote.
Yep.
The health insurance czar, Justice Anthony Kennedy, will ultimately rule. It'll be like that close election in 2000 between Bush and Gore. 5-4. That's how close that election was. All right. Thanks a lot to all three of you. I really appreciate
you
coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up in just a minute. We continue our Rut or Recovery series. This time we will look at whether New York area restaurants are in a rut or a recovery. Stay with us.